Welcome to the Restoring the Sacred Circle podcast. In this episode, we welcome Dr. Dolores Sevilla Bigfoot, affectionately known in our communities as Dee. Dee has been working most of her career advocating for the health and wellness of Native children throughout the country. If you or anybody you know would like more information on problematic sexual behavior of youth in Indian country, please log on to our website, ncsby.org. We would like to give a special thank you to Andrew Vasquez and his music from his CD, Wind River.
Dr. Bigfoot, welcome to our interview. I'd like to start by just hearing a little bit about you.
I'm Dolores Sevilla Bigfoot. The community I'm from defines me as grandmother, mother, sister, daughter, elder. So that would be my Caddo Nation community, as well as my Northern Cheyenne community in Montana. I'm by employment or by work identified as a presidential professor at the University of Oklahoma Health Sciences Center in the Department of Pediatrics at the Center on Child Abuse and Neglect, where the National Center on the Sexual Behavior of Youth is located, and where I work at the National Center on the Sexual Behavior of Youth with adolescents and young children. I mean, major focus on adolescents with problematic sexual behavior.
Okay, thank you. In your own words, describe or define what problematic sexual behavior is.
You know, we're all social beings and we're all spiritual beings. And one of the things that we do as social beings is have connections and have a sense of belonging. You asked me about the community. So my sense of belonging, my identity comes from how I relate and interact and connect with other people from my community. And I have my Caddo Nation community where I'm enrolled. And I also have the Northern Cheyenne community where my children are enrolled, plus other communities, where I work, where I live, where I go to church. So there's different communities in which we work. And as social beings, we interact and we learn about what's appropriate and what's inappropriate, what the boundaries are. For example, with my first husband especially, he didn't have communication with my mother. So son-in-laws do not talk to mother-in-laws. That's one of the Cheyenne ways. One of the reasons for that is that it decreases contention and conflict and makes more harmonious relationships because there's no conflict. And my mother would say my son-in-law really respects me because she felt that he exercised a lot of control not talking to her, being respectful of her, but not creating tension between the two of them. So as we think about what is appropriate roles, what are appropriate boundaries, what are appropriate ways of interaction, what occurs is that for some children, some adolescents, they have difficulty in their behaviors or in their words or in their interest in sexual kinds of things. And there are normal sexual curiosity that most kids engage in. But for some kids, their sexual behavior makes other people uncomfortable, or their sexual behavior is invasive with other kids, or their sexual behavior is distracting so that they're not able to pay attention to learn or to do things that are more typical of kids their own age. So as we think about problematic sexual behavior, we have to think about a sexual behavior that presents a problem for that child or that adolescent or their family or their community. For example, if a 13-year-old is masturbating all the time and he's masturbating in the family room where everybody is sitting, that is highly problematic for him as well as his family, because the family would be very disturbed by his behavior, exhibiting actions that are not family focused. And even though masturbation may be okay within the family, but it's probably okay in private. And so when it presents a problem for the individual or the family or those that are around them, or if it's illegal or inappropriate, age inappropriate, or situation inappropriate, or words inappropriate. And so we can also think about it in terms of media, so pornography or texting inappropriate images of private parts, or taking pictures of other people's private parts. So there's a wide range of what could be problematic and inappropriate and or illegal sexual behavior.
What are some terms used to describe PSB in your work?
Well, I think that there are some terms that have evolved that were more about how we tried to contain adolescents. So for example, we use the term sex offender, predator, or child sexual assault. I mean, there's many different kind of terms that are that were used. And so what we want to do is to really think about what that means for that child or that adolescent, and helping them gain mastery over their thoughts and feelings and behavior so that they can interact and still be that social being, but not have their behavior, their words, or their actions be uncomfortable or harmful for themselves or others. And so I think there's been a lot of different terminology that we have used that hasn't been helpful in describing the behavior, hasn't been helpful in establishing services for adolescents, hasn't been helpful bring about a change in policies or a change in laws. So I think that the key part of that is, we think that we can shame individuals into behaving what we think is appropriate. And really, what we want to do with problematic sexual behavior understanding is teach children and adolescents what they can do to self-soothe if that's a need, and to learn this sense of self-mastery, self-control, self-discipline, and choose the places that are more appropriate for the kind of behavior that is, more typical of their age, and that would help them engage in more pro-social kinds of activities, and learn the social skills of communication, understand why they are needing to have particular boundaries, understanding about sex education, understanding about consent, understanding about sex laws and why it's not okay for 11-year-old boys to touch their little sister in inappropriate ways. So it, or have impulsiveness that, they're doing things and violating someone else's body, because understanding what consent is, being able to be respectful, having people ask you if it's okay to, give them a hug, okay to, touch their shoulders, okay to, pull their hair back out of their eyes. So if we really demonstrate that you ask, then the likelihood of having harm done is lessened. So a lot of this is about prevention.
Think back to a time when you encountered a PSB case. This could be a tribal PSB case or another PSB case. But where were you and what happened?
When I first became aware that adolescents engaged in inappropriate sexual behavior and illegal sexual behavior was when my son told me that somebody had molested him. So as I, you know, that certainly was, behavior that I didn't know adolescents engaged in. And that from that, when we think about the statute of limitation and we think about policies and laws and, treatment, how do we create opportunities for children who have, or adolescents who have inappropriate sexual behavior? How do we create opportunities for them to learn and grow from a better understanding of how their behavior impacts others, but to learn that mastery, learn that respect for self and that sacredness of self, as well as the sacredness of others. And it's actually been 30 years or so ago, I was a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Oklahoma Health Sciences Center, and was able to become part of an adolescent treatment program that Barbara Bonner started. So it's been over 30 years that program has been in effect, a treatment program for adolescents who have inappropriate sexual behavior. And then it has evolved to expand an understanding that, children under the age of 12 or 13 can engage in inappropriate sexual behavior. So there's actually three age groups that within the treatment program. So there's a treatment program for children between the ages of 3 to 6, and children between the ages of 7 to 12, and then a treatment program for youth between the ages of 13 to 18. So we have certainly became more aware of inappropriate sexual behavior in early ages. And we certainly became aware of what are, helpful additions to treatment. And so when I think about, cases, it's pretty broad. I have worked with families who were involved in our adolescent treatment program for problematic sexual behavior. And I think that what we have learned is that the more parents are involved in the treatment, the better the outcome and the less likely that children and adolescents are going to engage in a future inappropriate sexual behavior. And that by working with the parents and the adolescents or the children, that improving communication, getting a broader understanding of sexual behaviors, as well as what is normal or typical behavior, for that's age appropriate, understanding more detailed sex education, understanding problem solving, understanding decision making, understanding ABCs, the antecedent, the behavior, the consequences, how I think, how I feel indicates what I'm going to do, that it really improves the outcome. So I it's hard for me to think about, a particular case, but I think I can tell you that addressing sex laws for adolescents and young children. So as we think about being able to implement policies and procedures and laws and treatment, it really is about rehabilitation and intervening and doing prevention work so that we don't have renewed cases of, recidivism is low, and also we do a lot of prevention. So I think that I'm more in terms of the policy rather than the direct services, but certainly having family involvement and helping youth learn to have communication. I remember I asked one mother, and she was in there for, 12 months with her son. And I said, can you tell us what's different for you now that, from where you came in to where you are now and your son is graduating? And she said, yes. She said, I can tell you, last night is a really good example. She said, before, if I came home and I saw that the house was a mess, I would have started screaming and I would have started being really upset with them. And I would have said that they didn't appreciate me and they didn't appreciate our house. And they, I couldn't wait for them to get out. And so she, she said she would just have had a blow up about her house being dirty or messed up. And she said, now came home from work and I needed to go back to work. And she said, if I had come home from work and been, confronted with this messy house, I would have been, like I said, had a blew up at the boys, at both of my sons. And then I would have left the house. I would have been mad at them. And I would have gone to my, work related activity that evening. And I would have been miserable. And then I would have come home and the house was a mess. And I still would have been, angry about that. She said, I came home the other evening, the house was a mess. And I told my two boys, the house is a mess. Whoever wants to clean it up can clean it up. I will put $20. I will give you $10 a piece to clean the house. And then I left and I had to, go back to work, and I was okay. I was not angry. And I got home and the house was cleaned up and I was happy. The boys were, in bed studying or in their room studying. And I said goodnight to them. And I went on to bed. And the next morning I got up and my one son came down and I said, thank you for cleaning up the house. I put $10 for you and your brother on the refrigerator. And he said, Mom, I had too much homework last night, so I didn't clean up anything. Brother did it all. So he needs, he should get the whole $20. And she said, I don't know if we hadn't gone through this program, I would have understood how to deal with my sons. And I don't think that I would have taught them this honesty that my son said, I did my homework, Mom. I was busy with that. Brother gets the whole $20 because he did all the work. And she said, so there's been a lot of benefit from this program. And she said, his brother got all the $20. I was happy. They were happy. And I recognized that I was parenting much differently. And so now I can do things that are helpful for my kids. And we're a better family because of it. So as we think about, it's working with the families to help with that communication and to help them come up with different ways of confronting what are problematic relationships because of getting into the program because of their inappropriate sexual behavior.
I love that story. That's a good example. I want to move on. It's a nice segue to the toolkit. So I want to know, what you might do differently because of the toolkit, or maybe what you hope communities and providers will do differently because of it.
No, the thing about the program for adolescents who have problematic sexual behavior is that it is a more comprehensive program. So we involve the probation, we involve the courts, the law enforcement, the schools, the community. And it's not so much that everybody knows about the business of the families. It's just that because of their illegal sexual behavior, then the court is involved. How do we inform the court about what are the options for treatment. How do we inform the law enforcement about options for treatment and that you don't need to lock up 12-year-olds for inappropriate sexual behavior? How do we help the schools know that, yes, this 12-year-old is acting inappropriately, but with treatment, we can decrease that behavior, help him be a better student, more likely to graduate, more likely to join the service or go to college or do something much more productive, rather than if they get thrown into jail and or get thrown out of school or get suspended from school. And so what the toolkit is about is bringing in all the different entities that have an impact on how this adolescent is going to be treated. And so it's not just the clinical services that are part of this toolkit, but it's a comprehensive understanding that there needs to be an thoughtful authorities that are making decisions about this, about adolescents who have inappropriate behavior within their community. And, what we know is that there's a lot of those. Do they always get caught? No. But that we can intervene in a way that this adolescent doesn't need to go to jail. They don't need to be in detention. They don't need to be suspended from school. They can stay in the home and lessen the trauma that would result from being in detention. Or, we can keep them in school, so with appropriate supervision. So it really is looking at things comprehensively. And we know that in our tribal communities, there's probably a higher rate of child sexual abuse and inappropriate sexual behavior. So this toolkit is there to not only help the authorities, but also to help parents think about how they want to approach educating their children when somebody does something inappropriate, or utilizing the toolkit to teach children about appropriate sexual behavior. How early do we need to start teaching children about sex education? I think that we do a lot of things with, where's your eyes? Where's your nose? Where's your chin? Where's your elbow? Where's your knees? Where's your toes? And we leave a vast amount of anatomy that we don't discuss. I think that, so making it a natural part of educating children about their body parts and their private parts and helping them understand what's okay and not okay. The earlier we can share knowledge, the better we are. So as we think about this toolkit, it really is comprehensive in a number of ways. So we can think about it in terms of the authorities that have jurisdiction, as well as the parents that have supervision and parental rights to be responsible for their children. And I think that that's one of the key things that we can say is that, we have parents that have the right to be responsible for their children. So let's arm them with as much information as possible. Let's provide them with as much knowledge as possible to be able to parent their children in a way that helps them to be the sacred beings that they are.
Yeah, and that's perfect. That's actually the last question, like what advice do you have? And that's really it. Is there anything else that you would like to share or maybe talk about?
I think what we want to do is to honor our children. They come to us as gifts, and we need to remember that always, that even when they are aggravating, even when we're frustrated with them, even when they have done things that have potential harm for other people, we need to recognize that they came to us as gifts. And if we could always remember that they are the sacred gift that we are in charge of, for a short period of time, relatively short period of time, and that we can present them to themselves as sacred beings, that, you know, ancestors have prayed for, you know, this generation and this next generation, that if they can have that knowledge that they have been prayed for many generations, and they have a sacred work to do, maybe that sacred work is just being a delight for their grandparents, you know, that we have to recognize that they have they're here for a purpose, and we may not always recognize what that purpose is.
Thank you for being part of our podcast. If you know of anybody that would be interested in this information, please feel free to share. Our website is ncsby.org. This podcast project is supported by grant number 2019 MCFXK022, awarded by the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention, Office of Justice Programs, U.S. Department of Justice. The opinions, findings, and conclusions or recommendations expressed in this publication are those of the authors and do not necessarily reflect those of the Department of Justice.